Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Attention BetMGM customers. Have a friend who loves sports as much as you do? Here's a chance for both of you to earn a $50 bonus when they sign up through BetMGM's Refer a Friend program. Just sign into your BetMGM account and click on the Refer a Friend program to send your friend a message inviting them to register a new account in the same state you use BetMGM in. Once your friend signs up and makes a deposit, they'll receive a $50 bonus. And once your friend places a bet with their bonus and the wager is settled, you'll receive a $50 bonus as well. Share the excitement and get a $50 bonus every time you refer a friend to BetMGM. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. Must be 21 years of age or older to wager. Ohio only. New and existing customer offer. All promotions are subject to qualification and eligibility requirements. Rewards issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets. Bonus bets expire in 30 days. Please gamble responsibly. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Happy Thanksgiving. Hey guys, I just wanted to let you know that everything over at BirdlandSports.com, all the t-shirts, sweatshirts, and other things, is all on sale this week for Thanksgiving at 20% off. That includes film study t-shirts and sweatshirts. So head on over there and grab some Christmas gifts or grab a shirt or sweatshirt for yourself for all your Baltimore sports fans. Check out BirdlandSports.com.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. Here to talk about this week's numbers and by the numbers with co-host Dan Reese. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Wasn't the prettiest win, but still a win. So that was great. And looking for the team to hopefully get on a little roll, and pretty excited for Thanksgiving. So it's a good week.
They've all of a sudden won four straight games. It feels like it's been a while since that's happened. But a good little winning streak here. Before we go into the numbers here, though, I have to thank our sponsor, Liquid Death, the water that will murder your thirst. Please try their product. They've been good. Some delicious seltzer waters and regular, depending on what you like. They're served in a tall boy can, a little more efficient in terms of recycling. If you use plastic, just remember it's headed for a landfill eventually. And that's one of the selling points of this product that we appreciate. That said, Dan, folks can find you on Twitter. Exactly where?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at DP Reese 8, the number 8. And, happy to talk Ravens or whatever football related, reach out to me. So, all right, let's dive in. My first number is -0.37. That was the average EPA for the Ravens defense last week. So, wow. So negative is good for the defense. That's the fifth lowest EPA in 2022 so far across anyone. So a remarkable performance by the defense, really from start to finish. Finished really strong, but even throughout the whole game, they really held really strong, even despite the offense kind of putting them in some tougher spots. So, this was the second week in a row with the negative overall EPA for the defense, only the fourth for the season overall for the Ravens. So they've really gotten on a little roll the last 2 weeks, and man, did they look good.
Mm-hmm. Let's do a little math with that if we can, sure. Because hey, this is by the numbers and we do that. So they had something like 54 defensive plays, and it probably only measures them for that. And if I multiply that by 0.37, I get 20 points below average is what they allowed, which maybe that seems about right, about 23 points, and they only allowed three. And expected points don't always work out to actual points, of course, but should come pretty close, right?
Yeah, and they had a number of drives. Each team did. So I think you know, that probably makes sense. So 23 okay. is probably pretty close to the average, and especially given some of the field positions, Carolina was in. So.
And so you said it was the fourth lowest in the entire league for the year?
Fifth lowest the whole year.
So there's been maybe a couple shutouts, a couple other three-point games, probably not too many people giving up 3 points in as few plays as the Ravens did also, which would reduce further, I guess, the expected points per play. Even that seems counterintuitive that it'd be going that direction.
Right. Yeah. I think the parity across the league has really been shown. I don't know how many shutouts there have been this year. That'd be interesting to look at. But I think it was really, oftentimes you hold strong until the end or whatever, but to hold all the way out and really finish strong was pretty awesome to see. So.
A very cool game. So looking back at that game also, Lamar Jackson averaged 3.65 seconds to throw against the Saints. So the numbers, I'm jumping right into it, are 3.65, 2.63, 10.3, and 4.8. The 3.65, that was his average time to throw against the Saints, which was the longest in the NFL by quite a margin, by the way. Against the Panthers, that dropped to only 2.63 seconds. So he released the ball more than a second quicker. And that was a function of a few things going on, but it was the seventh fastest. We'll come back to that in a second, among 32 teams. So between week 9 and 11, his intended air yards also dropped from 10.3 to 4.8. Now, that's also a consequence of getting that ball out quicker, is you're going to be making some shorter throws. You're going to have less time to make some deep shots. Some deep shots can actually be fairly quick. You can get that ball out in about 2.1 seconds if you're really just throwing a go route down the sideline. But in this case, this was a case of Jackson really having some time to make extended plays against the Saints, who are one of the rare teams who didn't really bring excessive pressure after him. Well, Carolina was back to trying to pressure Jackson. They were fairly effective at it. They pressured him 15 times in the game. And what that meant was Jackson was having to get the ball out quickly a lot more often. And they did some scheme that as well. And another big factor that played into this was the weather. And I think whether you're looking at the Ravens playing having a substandard run game, the weather played a factor in that because, of course, the line of scrimmage gets more packed when the other team is not as fearful of the pass. Obviously, they had some good play from some of the Panthers' big player. I thought that Burns looks like a monster to me, but the even larger monster is Derek Brown in the middle of that defense, causing havoc in the middle. So, good game for the Ravens to pick a win out when Jackson really didn't have his normal amount of time to throw.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting game for sure on a number of aspects. A lot of screen pass attempts, I thought. Not many successful, but a lot that were attempted were close, I guess. And quite a few checkdowns as well, which was interesting to see from Lamar. He hasn't been, that really hasn't been something he's gone to a lot. It was kind of good to see him, take his reads and kind of get to it. That probably doesn't play into the time to throw as much, but definitely does with the depth of target for that one. Mm-hmm. So, it is interesting to see how the different teams have chosen to play him and how the offense has kind of adjusted accordingly. So, all right. My next number is 6. There were 6 drives that ended for the Ravens this week between the 50 and Carolina's 25. So not quite in the red zone, but over midfield without any points, excuse me. So the 6 of them that they got to that point and didn't convert to points. They stalled at the 43, the 45, the 29, the 41, the 40, and the 41 again. Resulted in 5 punts and 1 interception. And this was out of 11 drives, so not including the final one where it was just the kneel. So over half the drives kind of stalled in this sort of like middle no man's land almost. So I'm not sure if there's a term for that area of the field, but it really was kind of it kind of explained how the offense was doing okay, but not quite able to get there for points. And I think that was really what kind of showed in the game. It was really interesting because all season before this week, the Ravens have only had 6 drives that stalled between the 50 and 25. So equaled their whole season so far, just to kind of put it in comparison to where it's been. There were 2 more where I didn't count them in the 6 that they tried field goals and missed. So they should have gotten points or could have gotten points, I guess. So you could call it 8, depending what you want to look. Either way, you know, 6 to either 6 or 8 is remarkable to have that many in one game. And it really just shows how close they were to putting up more points making this not a close game at all. And it was an interesting aspect of the game, I thought.
Yeah, certainly not a close game. A lot of 30-yard drives for the Ravens, as I always say when they do some of this. But there's one I want to focus on, and this is an interesting one, Dan, because this is going to require some of your actuarial talent, I think, to work through this. The Ravens got to the 45 at the beginning of the second quarter, literally on the first play of the second quarter, sent Mark Andrews the line of scrimmage to try and draw the opponent offsides. Mm-hmm. Didn't work. And they ended up taking a penalty and punting the ball at that point. But it was a 4th and 2. And I look at that play, and my initial reaction, I was at the ballpark, I wasn't looking at the Ben Baldwin bot, was that there has to be a positive expectation for going for it on that play in terms of expected points. But expected points, if you did everything by expected points, you might make some bets in a game like this that you don't want to make. And here's the point I'm making. You're playing the Carolina Panthers. They're one of the worst teams in the NFL. You far outclassed them. And I know, you know, there are times during this game where it didn't really seem like the Ravens far outclassed the Panthers, but they really are a much better team than Carolina. And they should have the expectation that if the game is decided by a number of small bets, meaning all the plays that are made in their normal order of consequence, adding a big bet shouldn't really help the Ravens the way it would help a team who would otherwise be the underdog in the game. So another way, we learn about CAPM as actuaries, capital asset pricing model. One of the assumptions that underlies that is that everybody is a rational mean variance analyzer. But now I'm wondering about, is there another layer to looking at fourth down choices, mm-hmm. where you look not only at expected points, but also in the variance of the move? And you could define that in multiple ways, but you know, your expected value is obviously your friend, but your enemy when you're the favorite in particular is the variance of that wager. So
right. Yeah, absolutely. And really, I think that's the challenging part with looking at these models. And a lot of it is, you know, that's the average expected outcome, mm-hmm. over a huge population, right? It's not the average of one game. You know, that there's, say it's a 50-50, there's a 50% chance you make it, and then you have a higher percent chance of winning, but a 50% chance of not getting it, and your likelihood of losing increases probably significantly. So, yes. So I think that's to your point, is, you know, you'd rather let your strengths and edges throughout the game kind of play out versus kind of taking the risk and in a one game situation, right? You know, if you were playing baseball or something like that, where it's 180 games or whatever it is, you could take more risks. But in this short season, I think it really makes the risk much more dangerous. So
I wanted to ask you, because you're into the EPA models, I know, and you're familiar with NFL Faster. Are you aware of any of the change in win probability models referring to the variance also? It's usually got the, you know, it's almost always got the standard, the mu, the expected value. But do any of them give you the variance on a particular play as well?
No, I don't think so. I don't think any of them, well, I'm sure all of the models have it, right, in the formulas, but not in the engines that kind of derive it as part of the natural data. Yeah.
So you wouldn't get it in the Ben Baldwin bot or something. The other way they could show it is just show the leverage. So, and I think the Benoit Baldwin bot does actually show you that. So they show you if you make it, you're at, you know, 64%, but if you miss it, you're at 50. And that would be like a huge wager that you're making on a single play of the type I'm talking about. You, if you're the Ravens and you're playing at home against the Panthers, you might not want to make that gamble for just a 1% expected gain.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think also it really kind of goes into a lot of kind of whether you're using the, you know, general population model versus, whether you have a, like kind of the Vegas odds imputed or whatever, you know, to kind of take into, how a better team shouldn't take that bet. Right. So there are models, that do that kind of take into that, that idea that a better team shouldn't take that risk as much as a worse team. So, you know, that's a definitely a component to think through when you're making the decision. I think on one of your shows, they talked about, that the short run game wasn't executing as well. So maybe that's another thing to kind of think through. So there are a number of aspects, and really that's kind of one of the key things with all of this is that those models are just a tool in the decision making, right? Mm-hmm. You have to kind of think about where that all fits in. So into the bigger scheme of things going on. So
let's see, it's my turn, isn't it?
I
think so. I think all the way down to my second one already. So
good.
40%, 25%, and 31%. The Ravens converted 6 of 15 times, 40% on third down. It was their 8th consecutive game of 40 plus conversions. That's the longest in team history. And I'm told this, I did not check it independently, by the way. So I was want to toss that out there. And meanwhile, they held the Panthers to 25%. That's just 3 of 12. That was the 4th consecutive games the Ravens have held their opponent to under a 31% conversion rate. So 30.8 is the highest, 4 out of 13 during that period. This week, the defense was certainly more impressive on the conversion front. 40% exactly is not particularly good in the NFL. It's probably, I don't know if it's slightly below average or slightly above average, but it's not particularly either way. But the 25% is certainly way above average in terms of its defensively. The defense right now looks to me like they are coming together in a way we could only have hoped for. Emergence of Patrick Queen. Obviously, Kyle Hamilton go down is a big loss, but his emergence has been huge last year. The addition of Roquan Smith, the return of all the outside linebackers, the solidity, and now the optimization that's available in terms of playing those front five players is at an all-time high. I think this defense will be one of the best in the NFL the rest of the way. Part of that will be opponent-driven. The other part is they are just hellaciously talented right now, and hopefully there won't be more injuries coming.
Yeah, and then you throw in Marcus Williams, who just got designated for return. He'll probably be back in maybe 2 or 3 weeks or so. And throw that ball hawk at the backside of your defense, and that's another fantastic weapon to have. I think the great thing about the defense is they all seem to be really feeding off of each other. I think that's the big thing is another thing you had mentioned on one of your shows, and you really can see it, is that these plays aren't made singularly. This isn't, this isn't one person doing it. It is a full team effort, whether it's Roquan and Patrick Queen, whether it's the inside pressure and the outside pressure getting to the QB, whether it's Peters and Humphrey with the turnover. It's just, it really, you can really see them getting together and gelling. And I think that's just going to continue throughout the rest of the season. And they are going to be a huge component of how far this team goes. So.
Yeah. I don't want to repeat what I said in the other shows because you did a great job of summarizing it there. But if you talk to the 2000 Ravens players, if you talk to, Siragusa before he was gone, of course, and Ray Lewis would be a big one, but Rod Woodson would be another good one who would tell you the same thing. The word they're going to use is trust, is that, you're on a defense like that has so much talent back to front, you completely trust, get to your spot, provide your assignment properly, and the guy behind you will make the play if you set him up to do so. And the other part that comes with that trust is knowing that they're going to hustle to the play. You know, that everybody behind you and yourself too really needs to be trusted to hustle to the football, to hustle to the appropriate spot, and make that follow-up play when there is a missed tackle or there is, you know, an assignment where a block gets made, but he's otherwise positioned well. I just think this defense looks like they have it right now. It is a pleasure to watch them play defense. It's almost like the 2000 team. And then I'm not saying they're as good as that team, but it's almost fun to watch them go take the field after a nice punt has pinned the opponent back inside the 20.
Yep, absolutely. Just you look forward to kind of having the defense go out there, you know, which is a rarity for sure. So, all right, my next set of numbers is 81.25% and 36%. 81.25% is the percentage of pass plays this last week when they were in 11, 12, 0, 2, or 13 personnel, basically when they didn't have two running backs, a.k.a. Patrick Ricard, on the field. So that was 26 out of 32 plays. On the other side of the coin, when they were in 21 or 22 personnel, they passed 36% of the time, which means they ran 64% of the time. They're really kind of going kind of as expected with, you know, when Ricard's on the field running at a really high percent, and when he's not on the field, passing it almost every down. And, you know, one of the things about this offense is that their tight ends specifically are so, you know, multi-talented, whether it be blocking or receiving, and kind of the whole idea was that you get these tight ends on the field, and then you have no idea whether they're going to run or pass. Mm-hmm. And I really haven't seen that from the offense lately. And I think they've become a little bit predictable based off of their personnel. And you know, some of it is the downs and distance and everything like that. But you know, I really hope that they can kind of get back to dictating the defensive personnel and then doing the opposite in order to take advantage of it.
Tendency breaking. Yeah. Yep. I think that part of that, it's not just down and distance, because that obviously is part of it. But the other thing is that they're winning these games so substantially that they're going to run anyway. And that's the end of the Saints game, the end of the Panthers game, where a lot of runs when they were on offense. And, you know, just, you know, teams run because they win. I always have to make sure I'm getting that right when I say it. So I do kind of understand why that is. And the other thing about Isaiah Likely lost all his snaps in this game back to Andrews, and he was in more in designated receiving situations, which speaks to your point there that, you know, Likely being on the field was a big tell before the 2 weeks that he played more snaps and became a bigger part of the offense, particularly as a run blocker. Mm-hmm. And I thought they would continue with that. I mean, you know, you don't need Nick Boyle to be on the field for a lot of snaps. If you have Isaiah Likely and he can provide you the combination of a blocking threat and a receiving threat.
Yeah. Or Patrick Ricard for that matter, mm-hmm. you know, for the kind of passing downs or running downs, you know, throw Likely in there and, you know, run out of that if you trust him as blocking. But that's not to say Patrick Ricard, I'm a huge fan and he does phenomenally. So I hope that they can get back to using the personnel and as you said, tendency breakers and kind of get a little less predictable.
All right. Let's see. Is it my turn now? Yep. 110.1. 4.2, 86.4, and 4.1. 110 yards per game allowed by the Jacksonville Jaguars is 10th in the NFL, and 4.2 yards per rush is 8th. By the way, incredible to me. 4.2 yards per rush is the 8th best in the NFL. So teams are rushing for higher yards per play now in a passing league, which is a interesting trend. The Ravens, on the other hand, 86.4 yards per game allowed, which is 3rd, and 4.1 yards per rush, which is 7th, so just ahead of the Jags in that particular category. Flipping to the other side of the ball, the Ravens have 5.4 yards per carry as a team. That's 2nd. Jacksonville's 4th at 5.08. This is a battle not only of two of the league's best rushing offenses, but two of the league's best rushing defenses. And looking at the yards per game allowed by Seattle, the 10th best at, by Jacksonville at 110 yards per game. That number is really impressive because Jacksonville has been behind in a lot of games and the other team has been running because they're winning. And, you know, you figure you're, whether you do it efficiently or not, you're going to pile up some yards as you're doing that. And Jacksonville has still held the opponents to 110 yards per game. So I think considering their record, I think they're probably, you know, very close to the Ravens in terms of their ability to stop the run.
Yeah, that's really impressive. I think they have a really pretty decent linebacking core, if I recall correctly. And I wonder if some of that is play count driven. You know, if you've got kind of a really good rushing team, you kind of naturally have fewer downs, right? We've seen that, fewer downs on defense. But so we could have a record low number of snaps in this game, both teams wanting to just run the ball and kind of have the clock get going. So it'll definitely be interesting. But I think it is going to come down to, you know, whether those cancel each other out, where kind of, you know, the other aspects. And I think that's where the Ravens do have an edge, even though we haven't kind of seen it, you know, phenomenally this last couple of weeks. But I do think they have the edge over Jacksonville. So, all right, I'll go ahead and give my numbers about Jacksonville as well. 31 and 4.3%. Jacksonville is 31st in defensive pass DVOA. And their sack rate is 4.3%, which is 30th. So those are two areas where I think, Baltimore really needs to take advantage of that pass defense. You just talked about how strong their run defense is. So, I really hope that, Lamar can kind of right the ship a little bit and really take advantage of this weak defense. The low sack rate should be a nice break. Especially if McCary has to play a left tackle, which is looking more and more likely. So, hopefully they can have a strong performance on that end. So,
yeah, I heard it's going to be about 70 degrees. Actually, it looks like 78 and somewhat rainy with 15-mile-per-hour winds on Sunday. Well, we're going to the game. I'm not looking forward to that nearly as much now. But the heat will certainly be better Lamar weather, but wind is not a good thing for Lamar. Anything that basically allows that defense to compact around the line of scrimmage is generally speaking, I think, a bad thing for the Ravens offense. Anyway, we'll see how that works out. I'll go to my next number, which is 530, very simply. That's the winning percentage for teams coming off a bye since 2000. You will hear that number, and I will tell you that does not tell you the full story. I don't have the full story number, but the full story number is what's the winning percentage of teams coming off a bye when the other team is not coming off a bye. And so you have a lot of, just because of the number of weeks that can have a bye in the NFL, you have a lot of teams that are coming off a bye on the same week and play each other. It's been the case for, you know, several years for the Ravens having a bye of that type, where it's a shared bye. So because by definition, the winning percentages are 500 for all those teams with a shared bye, you can take a whole bunch of 500 play out of that 530 and you'd be left with maybe 550. Sound reasonable in terms of
at least, yeah.
Yeah. Thereabouts that you would have for the teams that are solo coming off a bye. I complain about this four times a year on the show, but I'll take one more time to do it here. Is that the NFL scheduling needs to get their crap together on this? There's no reason at all why any team ever has to face anyone coming off an uneven rest schedule like this with a bye. You just schedule divisional games always after byes. So you schedule divisional byes and then divisional games. And you don't have this problem. It is a very simple, formulaic, non-set theory expert way to do that. And it doesn't, I don't believe it would constrain the number of high quality schedules you could produce either. So I don't know why the NFL has decided that's not part of what they want to do, but for whatever reason they have.
Yeah, it's the whole scheduling process is so.
By now, you're probably noticing that there's strange tall boys of beer in the bottled water section of your local stores. Well, that's because it's not beer. It's actually mountain spring water from the Alps, and it's called Liquid Death. Why is it called Liquid Death? Well, because it will brutally murder your thirst, and their infinitely recyclable Tallboy cans help bring death to plastic bottles. They also donate 10% of their profits from every can sold to help kill plastic pollution. By now, you probably know how much I love Liquid Death. Well, every week I tell you about a different way I've used Liquid Death to mess with people. This week it was taking a cooler full of Liquid Death to the softball game. Because as our team chugged down Liquid Death, our play improved while the other team drank other stuff and maybe got a little sloppy out on the field. So take Liquid Death. The other team has no clue what you're doing. Or take it to work. We've talked about that many times. Drag it around to your friends at school. Maybe the carpool lane. Maybe we'll talk about the carpool lane next week. Just take Liquid Death. Enjoy it. It's ice cold water. You're going to have a great time and fun. Go get Liquid Death at your local Harris Teeter or 7-Eleven, or find Liquid Death retailers near you with their store locator tool at liquiddeath.com/filmstudy. That's liquiddeath.com/filmstudy.
Weird that it's such a black box thing. You know, like you said, they could do this and take out one aspect that's so variable without impacting the quality of the TV matchups at all. Like,
let me ask you a question. The black box is part of the problem. What if they came back at us and they actually had an internal formula that they're using for schedule fairness, in terms of maybe they have miles of travel and other considerations that I don't have in my annual schedule complaint column that I write. But if they added transparency in the NFL, would that make you happy if they said, you know, Baltimore already had a plus 18 schedule, so we didn't mind having them come with one other team coming off a bye. We didn't think that was unfair given how few miles they have to travel, and the fact that, you know, if we don't give the team coming off a bye, we have to give it to Arizona or something. They're already traveling a ton of miles. Would you feel any better if they gave reasoning on that said, hey, we want to keep everybody between, you know, plus 10 and minus 10 in terms of the quote unquote score we're using here. And here's how we did it.
Would I feel any better as an individual fan? Maybe not. You know, you still are passionate about your team and can kind of see differently than others may. But, you know, I think trying to be objective, I think it would help. You know, sitting here now, I'm not even convinced the NFL even pretends that they are trying to be fair. Like, do they say that they're trying to make balanced schedules? I don't know that I've ever heard them explicitly say, like, oh no, we, you know, make sure that they're all balanced. And I think they're more concerned about money and the TV than anything else when they make these decisions.
So. Yeah, and I guess maybe they should be. Let's just divert here for a second. I know this is longer than we intended to go, but the other thing that would really be a topic for transparency would be if we really understood how a particular officiating crew was marked down or scored for their performance for a game. Wouldn't you like to know how many points Jerome Boger's crew is docked for not understanding what the rule was on when you can challenge a play on the sideline, or, you know, for the quick whistle that they blew on the Humphrey fumble return TD?
I don't know if you see that and then you see them again later in the season as your ref, does it make you feel better? I don't know. There's nothing you can really do about it, like mid season at least. I think they do, you know, I believe they do in the NFL at least kind of choose the best ones in order for the playoffs and everything like that. I know they do that in some sports.
Yes.
Kind of like a Pro Bowl basically for officials. But it is amazing the range. And I think across the board, there has been some rough officiating this year. You know, I think both sides of the, you know, both teams benefit and everything like that. I think even this last game, the Ravens got away with some. There was one play, I think it was Drake, that was moving so early. Like he took two steps or something like that before the ball was snapped and it wasn't called a false start. So, you know, it does happen both ways, but it is weird to see such veteran officials, still fall short every year. So it's something that I often am amazed that such a high revenue organization like the NFL doesn't invest more in such a crucial part of the game. So, but that's a discussion for another day, I guess. All right. Is it my turn for the next number?
Yes.
All right. Okay. So my next number is a set of four numbers. So 0.1, negative 0.14, 50%, and 37%. So this is a look at early versus late down success on dropbacks. So early is first and second down, late, third and fourth down. So on EPA basis for dropbacks, he's got an average EPA on early downs of 0.1, which is 14th highest. And then on late dropdowns, however, he's got an average EPA of negative 0.14, 19th highest. So naturally does drop down into third downs and everything like that versus early downs, but more so for Lamar than kind of other teams across the NFL. On a success rate basis, where success is just anything that improves EPA, so kind of trying to take out how much EPA can change on first and early versus late downs, success rate of 50% on early downs, which is 13th best, versus 37% on late downs, which is 21st best. So he's definitely not performing nearly as well on dropbacks on the late downs versus the early downs. For comparison, looking at the run plays, early downs, an EPA of 0.03 versus on late downs, 0.45. So a huge difference on run plays and on success rate, 45% versus 69%. So looking much better in late down run plays and much not nearly as strong on pass plays.
Are those his run plays or are those any Ravens run plays?
Any Ravens. Any okay. Ravens run plays. So it's dropbacks versus run plays, design run plays. Yeah.
And it probably is true that a lot of there were some short yardage runs, no doubt, but there are probably a lot of late down runs that are Jackson scrambles or Jackson runs of some sort.
Yeah, and the thing about the short distance runs, though, there is a higher expectation of success or higher expectation of conversion already built into the model. So, if you are third and one or whatever, you're pretty darn likely to convert that. So converting it, because that's easy, doesn't actually give you a higher percent chance of kind of a large EPA. It may give you a higher percent chance of a success because even a small increase in EPA would be a success, but it kind of shrinks down your EPA possible on that kind of minimal down or minimal remaining distance. So,
gotcha. Okay. My turn, right?
Yep.
Minus 3% and 28.1%. The minus 3% is the total DVOA for the Jags. They are 13th in offense, 26th in defense, and 13th in special teams. They accumulated that versus the fourth easiest schedule in the league. And I always forget whether or not DVOA includes already a component for the schedule faced in their DVOA rankings. I think it might be opponent adjusted. But the Ravens at plus 28.1% DVOA are fifth in offense, 11th in defense. That's going to improve a lot, guys. And first in special teams, accumulated versus the ninth most difficult schedule. So even with or perhaps buoyed by the adjustments made, the Ravens are up to 28.1% and the Jags may have been a zero team overall or a slight positive even, but their easy schedule has dragged them into negative territory. The Jags did have decisive wins over the Colts and Chargers in weeks 2 and 3 of this year. They beat the Colts 24-0, the Chargers 38-10. It has been a long time since then, and they've lost 6 out of 7. The only win came against the Raiders, who are just terrible. So Jags are reeling. This bye week, unfortunately, came at a bad time for the Ravens, or I think they probably would have been favored by more in this game.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a matchup that the Ravens need to take advantage of, despite the bye week. I think the Ravens defense, you know, are all the way up to 11th is pretty impressive considering I think they were around 30th or 32nd or something like that after 3 weeks. So amazing the turnaround on their end. And, you know, so I really think, you know, they've got the Ravens have a lot going for them right now. And the Jags, as you mentioned, it's been a while since they've seen something positive. So hopefully we can keep that going. So, all right. My last set of numbers is 16-4%. Since week 3, the Ravens have only allowed 16 explosive plays. This definition I'm using is 20 or more yards gained. This is the lowest in the NFL across the board. That's at 16 plays, that's 4%. So one out of 25 plays, which is second best in the NFL, only behind Dallas. Only two plays last week, two explosive plays last week, and one the week before. So they're not only are they doing well on the turnovers, doing well on third down conversions, but they're also really limiting the kind of explosive plays, which we've seen and talked about before, that are huge components of an offense scoring. So being able to limit that makes it really difficult on the offense, the opposing offense. Match that with your third down conversion percentages, and you are in a really good spot.
So if memory serves, the big play against the Saints was also the missed tackle by Peters on the sideline on the disputed play, right?
Yeah, so that maybe shouldn't even count.
Probably
so,
not.
Right. Yeah, throw that one out. So there you go.
All right, two numbers to finish us up here, 13.9% and 0%. So I'm using the PFR statistics. PFF has a little tougher measure for this, for missed tackles. And Patrick Queen, through the first 5 weeks of the season, had a 13.9% missed tackle percentage. I think that's actually generous. It would be higher by PFF standards, somewhere in the 17 or 18% range. But here's the big news. Since then, last five games, he has made 39 tackles without a miss, according to PFR. If you believe PFF, he's made 38 tackles and had one miss during that stretch. So very efficient tackling at a completely different level. And it's not just he for the first 4 weeks of this, I'm going to say, he did a great job of being better at hanging on for dear life, I'll say. So he made some stops. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to downgrade him in that way. But he made a lot of twister tackles too, where he's making sure he's getting the guy down. But there may be a little bit of additional drag in here. This last game, he was in the gap stopping people. So I am so happy with this turnaround. It's been protracted now, but it's even been elevated, I believe, in this last game. Whether it's Zach Orr, whether it's Roquan, or whether this is all Patrick Queen kind of figuring out all at once, I don't really care, but it's wonderful. And the Ravens ought to try and figure out what helped them replicate this. If it is Roquan, if he came in and, you know, is making Patrick Queen a better player, it really does increase the impetus necessary to sign him, I believe. I mean, if he was not the guy who did it, well, you know, maybe Patrick Queen can take his spot next year. You save $20 million on the cap and you spend it on Lamar or wherever else that's appropriate, so you're not paying two inside linebackers. But if Roquan is really the one making Patrick Queen this much better, Ravens can't afford not to sign him if that's the case. So hopefully they'll do some self-scouting and really figure this out. The other thing about this is that you've got to consider what's the chance of regression, because we certainly have seen regression at times from Patrick Queen before, but the main part was he's never gotten to this level as a tackler ever. I actually think it's very unlikely that he'll regress now significantly. Now, he may not be he's not going to play as well as he did in this last game every single game, because, you know, nobody can keep that up. But is he going to regress as a tackler such that he's not, you know, getting to the hole appropriately, he's not sticking people in the hole and standing them up, as opposed to, you know, twisting them down, holding on for dear life, giving up extra yakko on run plays. You know, I think he probably has flipped the switch and he's enjoying being a good defensive player so much that I can't see him regressing at this point. Where are you on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, first first kind of to talk about where it came from, I think it's probably all those things, really. You know, I think a lot of it is also probably mental. You know, I feel like a lot of it probably is him thinking too much and just kind of being able to kind of, you know, get the monkey off your back and just go out there and play and kind of have fun, and success kind of breeds more success. So I think that's a lot of it. As far as his regression, I think because of that aspect of it, I think that it's less likely for him to regress, in my opinion. However, the only thing I think that could really kind of lead to it is like, you know, knock on wood, an injury to Roquan or an injury to something, a different defensive player that would change his assignment, change his, you know, the kind of success that he's seen, the types of role that he's being asked to play, you know, kind of more see ball, hit ball sort of deal, you know? And I think that could be the kind of one thing that could cause a step back. And I think that happens not just to him, but to players all the time, is when they're forced out of their natural position or natural role, they kind of, you know, become less successful, right? So I think that'd be the hardest thing to see, I think, is to just to have something like that stop his momentum. So
yeah, I have, people have been also down on Odafe Owe, but he's one of the guys I'm really high on for the rest of the season. He had a big pressure game this time, 5 pressures as I counted. I know PFF had only 2, but I count them on up to 3 seconds and when they're in the cone. And Owe's pressures really was a big part of the defense in that second half. And he did it only 14 plays that resulted in a pass or sack. He had 5 pressures. So rate was up there. He looks like he's back playing the right position again, to your point about having the role you're most comfortable with, playing on that rush side and not opposite a tight end, but back to trying to figure out how to beat a tackle all by himself on an island, where he can use a lot of his natural athletic gifts to create a pass rush plan.
Yeah, and I think this kind of goes back, just to say one more thing on about it, is, you know, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about the, you know, selfless defense and things like that. You know, he may not show up immediately in the sack numbers, but, you know, whether it leads someone to scramble from the pocket and, you know, get tackled by Roquan or Patrick Queen or by Justin Houston, you know, who's gotten a few cleanup sacks himself. So, or Calais Campbell for that matter. So, you know, he can have a huge impact even if he's not having a direct impact on the stat, you know, the kind of top line stat numbers. So, and I think he has, with, like you mentioned, you know, looking at the pressures, that's kind of one of the ones that, you know, people may not look at first is pressures and, you know, but seeing him have that high of a number for that low of sacks just kind of shows the impact that he's having. So,
yeah. Outstanding. Always a blast to do this show with you, my friend. Tell folks where they can find you and talk football with you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a great one. Reach out on Twitter, DP Reese in 8, happy to talk Ravens or football, whatever. Want to say to everyone, have a happy Thanksgiving and, you know, have a safe and happy holidays for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Mirror that entirely, especially the safe part here. You'll do some drinking and hopefully get home safe. Be careful out there on the road. You know, there's a lot of people who've had a couple, tomorrow night. So, anyway, appreciate you listening. If you have a film study short you'd like to do, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. You know by now what's going on with that. Dan, we'll talk to you next week.
Absolutely.
Talk to you next time on Film Study.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.